You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 563, the best live performances in history, Adele on Desert Island Discs, and the complicated life of Dave Davies of the Kinks. That's all coming up after the Rosillos and Top of the Pops.
This song came into my thoughts this week and led me to playing their debut album. What a great band. Leaders of new wave music in the late 1970s. Singer Faye Fife, now a clinical psychologist under her real name, Dr. Sheila Hind.
Did not know. How interesting. Yeah.
But still performing with the band. Number 17 in the UK in 1978, the Rosillos and Top of the Pops.
That's a belter, that. One year, my friend Stephen bought me a load of random records from a shop in Bexhill from their £1 pile. He didn't know any of these records. He just picked them from stuff that he thought sounded good. Or, for example, he was an accountant, so he bought me Pocket Calculator by Kraftwerk because he wrote it was relevant to him. Walking the Cat Named Dog, things that he thought were funny. And he bought me Top of the Pops by the Rosillos, and I still play it regularly. So thanks, Steve, for kindly giving me records you knew nothing about that turned out to be very good.
They were great. Thank you for joining us for Parish Council episode 563 episode. I'm Terence Stackham, and of course there's much press gossip, and we can find out the answer here with Jerry Hall and Rupert Murdoch getting divorced. Rupert Murdoch has a vacancy. Are the rumors true about Juliet and Rupert? Let's ask Juliet Harris.
Hello. I mean, this is the most offensive introduction yet from my point of view. Although, having said that, I was going to say, well, I'm sorry to have to let Rupert down not so gently. But having said that, though, if Jerry Hall is available, do please give me a call. Hi.
As we record this, the 2022 Euro football tournament for women players is underway. Mm. I watched England's first game against Austria, and I've got to confess, I found it rather dull. So I turned over at half time. I was watching on TV. This week I noticed they were playing their second game against Norway, and I thought, well, I'll give it another go. Thank goodness I did. What a match. But why should I tell you about it when Juliet was actually there?
I know. What a game to get tickets to. So many months ago, I'd looked this up in my emails because my friend Janine very kindly wanted to go to the matches. So she said, I'm going to put in for the ballots for the Euros. Would you come with me? And I was like, well, yeah, great. She's like, some of the games are at Brentford and some are at Brighton, and that would suit you. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds perfect. So I looked up my emails. November 2021, we procured the tickets to three matches, to the match that we're about to talk about, England versus Norway. So all three matches allocated to the Amex in Brighton, also, well, it's in Falmer actually, but it's in the People's Republic of Brighton and Hove. We are going to see Austria versus Norway tomorrow evening at the time of recording, and we also have tickets for the quarterfinal on Wednesday, which we will now feature England, we know, because it's the winner of Group A versus runner-up of Group B. So what can I say? The £15 the ticket cost me, Terence, for Monday evening for England's 8-0 thrashing of Norway. And I'm afraid to say for the Norwegians, it was a thrashing. So the attendance was 28,000, which
that's
was
pretty good.
I mean, it was almost sold out. And there were a few sort of empty patches, which I suspect might have been COVID related. But having said that, it was very busy, well, I mean, by the end, it was basically a sort of a rave atmosphere, really. People were very keen on it. We were seated in the south stand, so we were able to see the television pundits on the gantry to our left. We were very much enjoying Alex Scott dancing along at one point. She seemed very keen on watching the action. And when England had gone 7-0 up, we all, you know, boisterously, as some people would say, sang, you know, the chorus, the Three Lions, to be filmed on our phones by Ian Wright, on their phones by Ian Wright and Alex Scott leaning over the gantry to film people singing. It was an amazing atmosphere. The stadium in Brighton is always very well administered. Stewards were helpful. We accidentally got let in with drinks at the beginning of the match, which meant when we weren't allowed back in at half time with our alcohol, it was a little bit of a surprise. So my euphoria in the second half was partly because England was 6-0 up at the start of the second half, and partly because I just had to drink a pint of cider in 3.5 minutes. So you know,
it's one of these arcane rules. We get this at Chelsea, where even in the hospitality area, they have to pull the blinds down. At half time so that you can't watch the game and be drinking alcohol at the
I've actually been on the other end of that at Brighton before, because I've been to corporate hospitality before. So yeah, anyway, that was what it was. I think it's a lot of fun, and it was great. I felt a little bit like Forrest Gump unwittingly attending a moment in history as the women's team won by the greatest margin that a male or female English team have ever won by in an international match, I think, so, or at the Euros anyway. So yeah, we were very, very much enjoying ourselves, and feel like we were living our best lives.
Well, talk about moments in history. Coincidentally, there was an interesting piece in the Daily Telegraph this week where various writers and contributors wrote about live performances that they'll never forget, and not just music, but also across the arts and sport and politics.
Yes.
And with Michael Deacon remembering Theresa May at the 2017 Conservative conference, when
who
everything
could ever
went wrong
forget
for her.
That?
Firstly, the comedian Simon Brodkin handed her a P45 employment form, and then Mrs. May lost her voice, and finally the stage backdrop began to fall apart behind her. Deacon calls it the worst live performance ever. Other writers recall more positive events with Blondie, Paul Scofield, James Brown. Any performances you remember that swept you off your feet, Jules?
Well, I could cite a political performance, actually, in terms of atmosphere. I mean, ultimately, the outcome of it was a failure rather than a success, if you want to talk in long-term terms. But I saw Ed Miliband's leadership. So I saw his party conference speech when he was Labour leader at the 2012 party conference. Now, this wasn't the unfortunate 2014 one where he forgot things and it all went a bit wrong. But this was one where I was in this, I think it was the GMEX as it used to be known in Manchester. So it was like a sort of a stadium, really. And through absolute luck, we queued and queued and queued for tickets to get into the hall. We had conference passes, so we had these black tickets in our books that you had to have, but the queues were massive. We were in this queue for about an hour, and we just got to the front, and the doors shut behind us, and someone said, "I don't think there's any more seats. I'm not sure. You'll have to try and find something." And I ended up at the side of the stage, three rows from the front, sat next to an MP and a member of Labour's executive committee. So I really should not have been in that seat, but I ended up in that seat next to a member of the NEC who said, "If I do nod off, could you wake me up?" So that's always a good atmosphere to have. So we got to watch from the side of the speech. And so we could see the Shadow Cabinet reacting at the same time as Ed doing the speech, which was really interesting. And he did the speech, which was extremely good. And there was a lovely bit halfway there where he turned around and just had this line about, "Have you ever seen such a load of U-turning, pledge-breaking, NHS threatening chances or something?" And the whole room just erupted. It was just such a wonderful moment. So I will always remember being in the room for that. We talked earlier in the year when I went to see Goldfrapp, and I genuinely think that was outstanding. I'm not sure there will be many gigs that will beat the half an hour silence that greeted Alison Goldfrapp at the beginning, because it was just so intense. I saw, and again, this is rather serendipitous, we managed to get ticket four rows from the front to see Waiting for Godot at the Brighton Royal Pavilion Theatre. And if you want an idea of how good the cast was for that, the bottom of the bill was Ronald Pickup. Mm-hmm. The second bottom of the bill was Simon Callow. So these are not the stars. And then the joint top billing were Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart, the Sirs. They were the lineup. And it was £40. This was about 12 or 13 years ago, and I'd studied it at school. And I think that's probably the best theatrical performance I've ever seen, because it was just box office from start to finish. And it was a play I knew as well. That was really sort of important to me. So in terms of performances like that, I mean, again, sometimes it depends where you're stood. Being on the front row to see the Pixies in a 1,500 capacity venue a few years ago, that was pretty incredible, I must say. And I did buy a mug and a tea towel, and I think of that evening every time I use them, because that's the audience they're catering for now. So that's I very much enjoy that. I'm just, like a lot of people, really glad to have arenas back for sort of people performing again, I think. But in terms of performances that will stick with me, those are the ones that I immediately reach for, just because they were just so good, I think.
Having seen Chelsea in three cup finals and they lost each one, Wembley doesn't hold good memories for me.
No, I'm sorry.
Probably the most remarkable football match I've seen was when Chelsea beat a team from Luxembourg 13-0 in a European game. And I remember one of the Luxembourg defenders played in spectacles throughout, and every time he went up for a header, the spectacles used to come flying off. And they had a winger who only had one arm. Which was a disadvantage when it came to throw-ins. But 13-0. Probably my greatest sporting memory is relatively recent. It was I was lucky enough to be at the Oval in September 2018 when Alastair Cook scored 100 in his final Test match.
Lovely.
You just sort of knew you were watching a moment in history. I'm lucky enough to have worked on a lot of movies over the years. I'm not sure if that counts as a live performance, but I bunged it in because working with and particularly watching Meryl Streep in 2015 was just absolutely magical. It was a genuine star of her craft, and I'll never forget those weeks. But music-wise, I had to whittle it down. Paul McCartney, Crosby, Stills and Nash at Hammersmith before the big fallout. Barbra Streisand, Fleetwood Mac, Back to the O2. My dad taking me to see Cilla Black and The Who in the 1960s.
That's incredible.
An amazing night at a tiny pub in West London, the Nashville, watching The Police with Sting perform in front of about 75 people in the late 70s. But best performance ever, of course, Kate Bush, opening night at Hammersmith Odeon, 26th of August 2014. Absolutely magical, emotional, and, you know, a night really never to be forgotten.
That's incredible. I was not quite into Kate Bush enough at that point in time to go, but everyone I know that went, it was exactly the same as you. And actually, I think I've said this before whenever we talk about this, so apologies if you heard this before, dear listener, but my bandmate went and brought back a bit of the confetti that was thrown out with the lyrics on it that that she had framed for me, that actually I look at. It's on the wall that I stare at when we do this podcast each week. So I'm looking at it at this moment. So I mean, that sounds phenomenal. I can give another live performance that's particularly good, which will surprise nobody. But it's always a good sign when you go and see a gig and you enjoy it, and then it gets a 5-star review in The Guardian the next day. And this has happened to me twice, seeing PJ Harvey and John Parrish at the Corn Exchange in 2009 in Brighton, touring A Woman and Man Walked By, which we saw PJ Harvey barking like a dog whilst walking across the stage, which was very memorable and very enjoyable. And also Stereolab at Concord 2 in Brighton in 2019 also got 5 stars, and one of my favorite gigs, because how can I put it, Terence, they did all my ones. You know, when you think, I hope they do that one, and yes, that one, and that one, they did all the ones for me. So yes, big fan of that also. But no, I bet that Kate Bush gig was just out of this world.
Well, here's a coincidence, because you're talking about what you look at right now. I'm looking at right now a framed piece of the confetti from the gig. The ticket I had for the gig.
Excellent.
Both framed underneath a large poster of Before the Dawn with Kate Bush with a life jacket around her neck. So we're both looking at Kate Bush.
This is why we're so simpatico, Terence, exactly, because we've got the same bits on our wall. This is why we agree on everything. We've never disagreed on this podcast,
ever. Never. Coming next, Adele on Desert Island Discs. That's right after Belinda Carlisle. I was high.
Suddenly I can't swim, so this is just
I think that's such an underrated single by Belinda Carlisle, who's had some great songs in her own right. That, not that I don't like it, but there is more to her than Heaven is a Place on Earth. And I love that. That's a sort of 90s classic from her. It's got a slight leaning towards Eurovision of that period, which I quite enjoy as well. It wouldn't surprise me. It's not a million times different to something like Love Shine a Light or something like that. It's very sort of radio friendly mid to late 90s pop, which I would just eat up all day every day, really. But yeah, I was reminded of that when I was being particularly stressed the other week, and I listened to this six times on repeat because Suddenly I'm In Too Deep felt very relevant to me at that moment in time. But no, I love this. I think it's great. In Too Deep by Belinda Carlisle.
Terrific single. Love Belinda Carlisle. I interviewed her about 10 years ago. Yeah, lovely woman.
I bet she's nice. She seems nice.
Really nice, yes. We were chatting in a bar in the... I can't remember the name of that hotel that looks over Hyde Park at the ends of Kensington High Street.
Oh, I know the one you mean, and I can't remember what it's called, but yeah.
Desert Island Discs. Just saying the name, I hear the sounds of the waves breaking on that shoreline.
Yes, indeed.
Eric Coates' Sleepy Lagoon there, as demonstrated by Juliet.
Thank you.
It has a simple format, and the fact that it's been running since 1942 is possibly a tribute to that simplicity. A castaway, usually a famous or notable person, they're asked to select 8 recordings, a book, and a luxury item to have with them on this notional desert island. Some castaways maybe get the wrong idea. In 1979, Dame Moira Limpany chose 8 of her own recordings.
Julie
broadcast. There's only been 5 hosts of the show since 1942.
Which is incredible in itself, isn't it, really, when you think about other revolving door formats.
Absolutely. And the first presenter, Roy Plumley, he did the job for 43 years.
Wow.
Now, in 2018, Lauren Laverne took over, and this week our interest was raised when we noticed that Adele was the castaway, Jules.
Indeed, yes. So I'm quite a fan of Desert Island Discs.
Are you? Right.
Yeah, and have been for some years, actually. I've listened to them in all sorts of scenarios. I listened to them driving round. I listened to them in the days when I used to go to the gym. They were quite good for the treadmills, actually. I used to quite enjoy just padding along on a treadmill for half an hour and listening to a castaway. And I remember having to explain to the person on the treadmill next to me that I couldn't stop laughing because Kathy Burke's luxury that she chose was a light-sized laminated cutout of James Caan, and I just this nearly destroyed me on the treadmill there. She's like, oh, so I could body surf on it if it was laminated. So yeah, couldn't quite deal with that, I must admit. But now I'm a big fan of it as a format. And actually, so Lauren Laverne's hosted this for a few years, as you say. She took over from Kirsty Young, who was poorly at the time, so went off on leave and then didn't return. She's much better now, thankfully, and could be seen commentating to great effect on the Jubilee coverage a few weeks ago, which was great. And Lauren Laverne gave a very typically gracious sort of press release at the time, saying that she wished Kirsty better and she hoped she would come back and all that kind of stuff. She was keeping the seat warm. She's come under some criticism, Lauren Laverne, for being a bit soft soap on this. Actually, so this particularly, I thought, this conversation she had with Adele, I think it works. I mean, sometimes it doesn't work and it can tend towards the bland. But then you could say that of all people. Everyone has a different style. We learned this on Women's Hour. It's got a different vibe now with Emma Barnett than it did with Jenny Murray and Jane Garvin. Of course, Anita Rani brings her own thing as well. I really enjoyed this interview with Adele. I really like Adele anyway. And the thing that makes Adele so likable is she's still, despite being wildly famous and successful, I mean the biggest selling female artist from Britain ever, I think Lauren Laverne said in the intro. And you know, her, again, as they said, her album releases are world events pretty much. I mean, they sell in eye-watering quantities. I had a bit of experience with, I know somebody who was had a quarter share, or I know of somebody that had a quarter share in one song on the second album, I think it was 21, and that was enough in itself. A quarter share in one song on an album brought in an annual income of about £160,000, I think. So that's the extent to which these records have sold. She's big, Adele, really, really big. she's also, despite all this, still manages to come across as somebody that lives next door to your sister. I think we all know an Adele. We've all worked with an Adele. We've all had an Adele cut our hair. We've all, you know, familiar with Adele in accounts or somebody like that. She's got this incredible quality to her that you just sort of feel like you know her already. Now, it could be that that in itself is a bit of a skill, but she is incredibly candid. And actually, for all that this didn't have very sort of hard hitting David Frost questions in it, I learned quite a lot about Adele that I didn't know. And I mean, I'm not a big fan in that I have everything, but I will, you know, if there's a piece about her in the news, I'll read it. Or, you know, if there's an interview or something, I would read it. And I learned quite a lot. She was quite open about her relationship with her father, from whom she was estranged for some time, about her time growing up with her mum. And I enjoyed the music she chose. I thought it seemed very authentic to her. Sometimes when people go on, or when particularly when politicians go on, you get the sense that the music has been a bit focus grouped. And I think David Cameron took particular flack for picking the Eton Rifles, and it's like, you went to Eton, I think you've missed the point of this. But I enjoyed Adele's memories of things like Dreams by Gabrielle and Rome by the B-52s that she remembered when she was young. And I thought she was quite open about the fact she'd been in therapy and that she'd sort of changed her attitude to life. And I think that a conversation like that, which is not, you know, not aggressive interviewing, and I think I'd compare it to something like today as well. I'm not sure that those interviews where, you know, the did you threaten to overrule him style interviews on Newsnight. Well, firstly, are they appropriate for performing artists anyway? Do they deserve the same level of scrutiny as politicians? That's a question in itself. I don't know what the answer is. I'm just throwing it out there as a question. But also, I think they generate a lot of heat, but very little light, really, because people become defensive and they shut down. And I think that I've noticed a pattern in Laura Laverne's interviews is that she often starts off a bit sort of soft and a bit kind of sort of stiff and a bit sort of I'm asking you something that I obviously know the answer to because I've researched this. But often I think that relaxes people into relaxing. And I do get that impression. And I think that Laura Laverne does get some quite sort of deeper stuff than perhaps other approaches do. So I get it doesn't work for every interviewee. And there are some interviewees that go on that you just think, why have you gone on here? I remember Morrissey being spectacularly rude to Kirsty Young and me thinking, what was the point in you going on, for goodness sake? But actually, if you have someone that's willing to open up, but you know, if there's someone like Adele, she was very, I enjoyed her saying that she's now very careful about who she lets into her life. And I think that's, I'm glad for her, if you see what I mean. And that was clearly translated to her approach in being interviewed. But actually, I think the soft soap thing can give us a bit of a deeper insight into somebody than is perhaps first obvious. And actually, I think that's quite shrewd and quite clever. So I was a fan of this programme, and I like Desert Island Discs generally.
I thought there was some unfair criticism in the press of Laura Laverne this week when some commentators wrote that she was too soft on Adele regarding the debacle of the postponed shows in Las Vegas. But that isn't what Desert Island Discs is about. It's a gentle, supportive format aimed, I think, as you said, at teasing insights from the guests. And I think one of the successful points of Desert Island Discs is an obvious one, because it is audio only. Being on the radio, the guests are far more relaxed, and also they know that the show is not a confrontational one and they're not going to be interrogated. Adele was quite interesting, talking about her childhood in Tottenham and, as you said, dancing around the living room to the B-52s with a very young mother who had Adele when the mother was only 18.
I knew she was young. The story that she used to take a 3-year-old Adele under her trench coat into gigs was just incredible, wasn't it, really? What an amazing image.
There were some deeper moments. As you say, she talked about her alcoholic father, their estrangement and reconciliation before he died. But what I found quite interesting, and I may be reading too much into this, either she has a shield up when talking about these things, or because she has talked about them so often, probably in interviews, she sounded almost neutral when talking about emotional issues, including her divorce. But I was, like you, I was interested when she talked about her anxiety, nerves and stage fright and therapy. And the stage fright that she equated as being the result of her passion for her performance. Mm. So to be able to overcome that in such a successful way is quite an achievement. I felt she came over well, if guarded. Yeah. Maybe people will continue to say that Lauren Laverne should have been more penetrating, but I rather like the soft touch of this show, I have to say.
I very much agree. And also, just to push back on that slightly, and this is to come from my own experience of having had, well, I haven't had some for a few years, but I had therapy sort of on and off for about 8 years. Mm. And actually, if you have, and I can usually tell, and me and my friend were laughing about this at the weekend, people that can have therapy, that have had therapy, can usually spot other people that have had therapy, because you do actually end up talking about your emotions in quite a rational way, because you've spent quite a lot of time talking about them and picking them apart. And certainly in my case, if you do something like cognitive behavior therapy, you're sort of trying to rewire your thought process to kind of make it less emotional. And it's a really interesting thing. I accept this doesn't work for everybody, but it did work for me. And so actually when Adele was talking about things in very neutral terms, when she then said, you know, having had therapy, I thought, oh, that makes sense, because she sounded like somebody that had discussed their feelings in therapy and had sort of spent time analysing their feelings, as a result of which it does take the heat out of them a bit, I must admit. So it might well be that she is guarded, and I totally get why Adele would be guarded. I absolutely understand that. But also, sometimes it's a sign of healthiness, I think, that someone has perhaps had therapy and thought about that. So that's my only note on your comment. Otherwise, as always, Terence, I agree with you.
Adele on Desert Island Discs. It's available now for free on BBC Sounds. Next up, warring siblings, including Ray and Dave Davis of the Kinks. But our next track, I want you to come for a little walk with me, listener and Juliet.
Oh, yes, I'll put my shoes on.
Imagine you've just broken up from one of the biggest bands in the world, and you go to your record company and tell them you've written a single about a gay bon viveur who lives in New York, and you've got Manu Katché and Branford Marsalis to play on it, and thus A&M released this superb single from Sting.
Coffee, I take tea, my dear. I like my toast on one side. You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York. You see me walking down Fifth Avenue, walking cane here at my side. and combat gear to make a man. It takes more than a license for a gun. Confront your enemies, avoid them when you can. A gentleman will walk but never run. The manners make of man, as someone say. He's a hero of the day. It takes a man to suffer ignorance and smile. Be yourself, no matter what they say. Be yourself, no matter what they say. Be yourself, no matter what they say. Be yourself, no matter what they say.
I'm a legal alien, I'm a English man.
No matter what they say.
I love that track so much, as I do much of Sting's solo work. Not much of a success in terms of sales. 84 on Billboard, 51 in the UK.
That surprises me. Did it get a lot of radio play? Because
it seemed to be everywhere at the time. Yeah, absolutely. From 1988, and also to be found on the excellent album Nothing Like the Sun, Sting, An Englishman in New York. I wonder if it was the subject matter, Jules, I have to say, in a different age. You know, perhaps people, you know, turned away from it because
I wonder, the Quentin Crisp thing. Yes, I'm sad to say, Terence, that I probably agree with you, which just goes to show how matters have moved on in a relatively short space of time, I would say. But yes, maybe sort of mid-90s, it still wasn't quite there. I don't know. But it's you managed to successfully sell a Sting record to me with that introduction, I must admit. And as we discussed on the podcast before, I'm not exactly allergic. I'm not allergic to Sting. I just have a very limited tolerance for Sting. And you're a big fan, I know. And actually, I like that. For a Sting record, I enjoyed that. I think it's got quite a style to it. And like you say, didn't sell that well, maybe because of its subject matter. But it's quite unusual for a mainstream pop record. And it's one of those things that does kind of, the lyrics kind of catch your ear, don't they? And I think that's an admirable thing. So yes, I'm pro that.
I'm slightly addicted at the moment. There's a sort of channel, if you like, on YouTube that shows Sting every year at his Tuscan farm vineyard, I should say. He does solo performances in at the shop in the vineyard in Tuscany.
Wow.
And these are filmed, I assume, by somebody on a phone or whatever.
Yes.
But they're absolutely amazing. It's just Sting sort of very relaxed doing Englishman in New York or several of the other hits, several Police songs and everything. And he seems to do it every year. And you just see him just gently aging through the years and doing this every year. And I'm just slightly addicted to watching those. But just very quickly going back to Quentin Crisp, of course, you know, back now, it probably wouldn't have the impact, but when the play of his book The Naked Civil Servant was on the BBC, the stir that it caused throughout the country
was
so phenomenal, which is why I, you know, brought up maybe that was something to do with the lack of people queuing up to buy the single.
It's a shame, really, because it's a very unusual song, and I admire that.
Being in a band, especially if you're touring and recording regularly, it's understandable how sometimes people get on each other's nerves, I'm sure. And that seems to be doubled up when there are brothers in bands. The torment of the Gallaghers in Oasis, Creedence Clearwater Revival's Tom and John Fogerty had a spectacular fallout. Perhaps one of the saddest sibling breakups is Ray and Dave Davis of the Kinks. Ray Davis doesn't seem to say too much about it, but Dave Davis seems to carry a flaming torch about their relationship, which he calls toxic. And he seems to, he cannot fail to pour petrol on the fire every time he's interviewed. Now, Dave Davis has another book out, and at 75, he's giving a series of interviews to the media to promote it. It does seem to be full of stories of old time sex, drugs, terrible behaviour, especially towards women. He suggests he's never happy in a relationship because, in his words, he's always looking for someone better. He's had a breakdown. He's had a stroke. Now, I know, Jules, I know it's not for us to judge, but what a sad and peculiar life.
Does seem rather strange, doesn't it? I mean, this so firstly, the bitterness that Dave Davis carries, I always think, is perhaps partly to do with the fact that who is it now that goes on tour and performs all the Kink songs? That's Ray Davis, isn't it? He's the one that seems to have the keys to the catalogue, doesn't he? And also, you know, as the band's front person, that's the person that seems to get the songs, isn't it? So Liam Gallagher seems to want to perform a lot of the Oasis songs on stage. Noel Gallagher less so, with his High Flying Birds doing their thing. This review of this book by Kitty Empire in the Guardian from a few weeks ago. There's a lovely line in this, I think, from her. She said, "It's hard to know how to feel about some of the episode detailed in this book. John Lennon once noted how obnoxious Davis was, and he was an authority." So that's a bit like the time that Norwich, that famous "Let's Be Having You" quote at Norwich by Delia Smith at halftime when she was perhaps inebriated. Person that commented that she had perhaps had a liquid lunch, George Best on Sky's coverage, who was still alive at the time. And let's face it, if anybody would know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a bit of a comparison here. She says, like you say, he's at pains to detail how awfully he and, to be fair, many at the start of the year have behaved. The evidence is here. The baiting of Ray Davis, the volatile relationship with drummer Mick Avery, who once attacked Dave Davis on stage, if I remember correctly. The turds in hotels.
Sent him to hospital, in fact. Yes. Hit him over the head with a hi hat, I think.
That's insane. The turds in hotel sinks, drunkenly disrupted flights. Now, this is Kitty Empire's view. She says he's no way contrite enough about the habit of ditching wives and small children willy-nilly when a better offer came along. He's always torn, though, and guilty, which is nice, she says. He has explained... he talks about the relationship he's had with men, and this is what's so interesting and in a way disappointing. He's not sorry about the way that he's treated women, but he is sorry about the way he's treated men that were in love with him and treating same-sex relationships as second tier, which, I mean, obviously, hooray for people revising their views on same-sex rights, but here doesn't quite ring as sort of true, really. He does talk about his penchant for the occult, which dovetailed nicely into the breakdown he had, I think, as well. So it certainly sounds like it, like a sort of a weird ride here. This is another lovely sentence. I'm a fan of Kitty Empire as a writer. I always have been. And she's sort of endured from the enemy and is, I think, a rather elegant writer. She says, and what a sentence, "It reads like a benevolent transcendental revelation." I quite like that as a sentence. And at this point, you think, unlike with the rock excess narrative, who are we to judge Dave Davis's beliefs on things like this? He said, "Who cares what other people thought when his own wife expressed his sort of dismay at his dalliance with the trance medium? Who cares what other people thought? I'd nearly jumped out of a New York hotel window. And what's crazier, taking acid and ended up dead on the sidewalk, or reaching further inside my inner self?" So, God. I mean, it sounds like chaos, this book. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get to the end of this. I always think, Satie, with these books, would we be so welcoming of such a narrative of bad behavior if it was a woman rather than a man? And I have to say, most of the time, I always think the answer is no. And I just find this sort of boys will be boys attitude. Yes, maybe we're a bit more frowning upon it now, but it depends when you talk about bad behavior. I mean, firstly, at least he hasn't just glossed over it, I suppose. But when we talk about, when sort of rock stars talk about bad behavior, I think there are ways to do it that are contrite, actually. And I have to say, although I don't agree with some of his interests and views, I did enjoy Jules Holland's autobiography, the excellently titled Barefaced Lies and Boogie Woogie Boasts, which actually is much more reflected than that might suggest. And he was very open about the breakdown of his first marriage, which happened really because he was involved in a car crash with the woman that went on to be his second wife. And it turned out that that was the car crash revealed what was happening. And he speaks briefly but eloquently and kindly of his first wife, and basically said that she had been exemplary in her behavior about it, and she had behaved much better than he had deserved, and it was very much one of the best points of his life that she had been decent about it, and that actually he was very fortunate to have been able to move on and have a happy life afterwards because she was so decent and he had every respect for her as a result. And I thought, actually, for someone to be honest about their bad behaviour and so generous about someone else supporting in it, I think there are ways and means of owning your bad behaviour and still coming across as quite decent. I'm not that convinced that this Dave Davis book does the same thing.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I was thinking about the whole brothers in bands business earlier. Mm. And I wonder what the secret to making a success of it really is, because you've got the Greenwood brothers. They appear to thrive in Radiohead.
Oh, in Radiohead, yes. They seem to get on very well. And the Finn brothers seem to make a go of it in Crowded House.
And only the death of Malcolm Young separated him from his brother Angus in AC/DC. That was 38 years together.
And also the Deal sisters have managed to keep the Breeders going for some time.
Indeed. I suppose when it does go wrong, it may be a sense of frustration, perhaps, as you allude to, perhaps even envy from one of the brothers, usually the younger one, as you say, in the case of the Gallaghers and the Kinks. The older brother was the more creative, the main songwriter, so perhaps indeed some jealousy there. But on the other hand, just thinking about Dave Davis and Ray Davis, I mean, maybe the Kinks had run their creative course and there was no more to come. And of course, sadly, now he's 75, so Ray Davis must be, what, 77, 78?
Yes.
Maybe the time has passed for a triumphant return to live performances anyway, even maybe.
I suspect so.
I could, you know, the Glastonbury Sunday afternoon slot for one last fling, maybe, but...
Ray Davis has done that in recent years.
Oh, has he?
He's done that as a solo artist, I think. And was fine, and you know, Waterloo Sunset went down very well, as you would expect it would on a Sunday afternoon at Glastonbury. But again, you know, there's the sort of the men that dye their hair to stop themselves from going grey, and it looks a bit ginger and purpley, and the sort of thinning voice, and which makes me think that I don't think it's going to happen, Satie. I think it's, I don't think, you know, the only way in which you could ever imagine them being reconciled is actually to track back to Adele. Adele and her father reconciled when she found out he was very ill, and decided that that was the time to reunite. And it makes you wonder, what if one of them got very ill? Would that be the time? Who knows? But it would be sad if the bitterness would even transcend that.
I think you're right. No coming back after decades of acrimony. Thanks very much for listening this week. Good to have you along.
Very much agree with my learned friend, as always.
In a weekend where here in the UK it's reported to be going to be mega hot, what you need is some cooling yacht rock from Juliet.
Well, I could not agree more. Thank you very much, Sir T. Yes. Why don't you dip your feet in the relaxing yet also uplifting waters of Smooth Sailing, my show that I do for Noisebox Radio, an online station, Sunday evening, 7 to 9 p.m. You can very much turn on, tune in and float out to our lovely sort of 70s, often 70s, not always, but, you know, easy listening, yacht rock, M.O.R., classic pop, just stuff that is good. I think it's good. I try not to play records that are bad. They want to be very cool, but they're not bad. And I think that it's a nice vibe. So hopefully that will help cool you down. We managed to successfully ride the summer waves last week. I hope we'll do the same this week.
And now to play us out, talking about, as you say, siblings in bands, Jules.
Yes, indeed. I was lovely to pick this week, actually. I always have a bit of a rolling list of things that I want to pick for the pod, but this was something that sort of popped into my brain rather unexpectedly, which I rather enjoyed. And we've mentioned them just now. Siblings in bands, the Deal sisters, Kim and Kelly Deal. I play in a music league, and we recently had a round which was pick a band that has at least two relatives in the same band, and this was my choice. I picked Cannonball in the end, but I rather like this as a sort of a end of show, end of pod. I feel this should be used at the climatic scene in a sort of a grungy indie romance, if you see what I mean. I like this as a sort of as a closer. I think it's an unexpectedly emotional song by the Breeders. It really plays on Kim Deal's quite simple voice that works, that manages to be quite truthful at the same time. I think I really love this from the album Last Splash, which is one of my Desert Island discs. I think I do it with albums, Terence. I couldn't just have 8 songs. I had to pick 8 albums. But this is the Breeders and Do You Love Me Now.
If I saw you now, could I look in your
been listening to a Parish Council production.